Today is Friday, December 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, lawmakers argued and traded accusations for hours upon hours ahead of a vote to impeach President Donald Trump.
We're here today because the president abused his power. We're here today because he solicited foreign interference in the 2020 election.
Most members of Congress know, and now the American people know, there simply wasn't a crime committed here.
Former supporters of Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi watch in dismay as she denies ethnic cleansing atrocities in her country. Also ahead, a big decade for Beyonce. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, beginning as early as next week, President Donald Trump could become only the third U.S. president in the United States to be impeached by the House of Representatives. If the democratically controlled House votes to impeach Trump for allegedly abusing his power related to his dealings with Ukraine, the case would move to the Republican-controlled Senate for an impeachment trial, where the political landscape is much more favorable to the president. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on what a Senate trial would look like.
Senate will come to order.
In the Senate, a call for divine guidance from Chaplain Barry Black.
Lord, guide our senators to the right paths. Lead them beside still waters. Restore their souls.
The Senate has been down this road before. In 1999, President Bill Clinton was acquitted of perjury and obstruction of justice related to his affair with intern Monica Lewinsky. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson survived a Senate trial by a single vote after he was impeached for violating a congressional act protecting high government officials from removal.
There was absolutely nothing done wrong.
In the case of President Trump, House Democrats have accused him of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress by allegedly pressuring Ukraine to investigate a political rival, Democrat Joe Biden. Congressman Jerry Nadler chairs the House Judiciary Committee.
Our president holds the ultimate public trust. When he betrays that trust and puts himself before a country, he endangers the Constitution, he endangers our democracy, and he endangers our national security.
Trump has denied the allegations and is counting on Senate Republicans to vote to acquit him in an impeachment trial.
The radical left Democrats and the failed Washington establishment are trying to erase your votes, nullify the election, and overthrow our democracy. Not going to happen. Don't worry about it. I wouldn't lose too much sleep over it.
Congressional Republicans have remained loyal to Trump, with only a few senators voicing criticism so far, says Julie Pace.
It doesn't mean that they will vote to convict him, but it does mean that we may see a scenario in which you have at least some members of Trump's party expressing real concern about his interactions with Ukraine.
To remove the president from office, two-thirds of the Senate, 67 out of the 100 senators, would have to vote to convict Trump on one or more articles of impeachment. That's very unlikely, says Larry Sabato.
I don't see how in the world you could ever get 20 Republican senators to vote to oust Donald Trump. They might as well vote to oust and then announce their resignations, because they won't be serving for very long once they cast that vote.
No matter the outcome, a Senate impeachment trial will be a demanding test for U.S. democracy, says Democrat Mark Warner.
And I would hope and pray that all of my Senate colleagues will take a deep breath, no matter kind of where we've been so far, and step back and realize this is probably the most important constitutional responsibility we have.
Even if Trump survives a Senate trial, his actions on Ukraine will likely be a top issue in the 2020 presidential campaign. Jim Malone, VOA News.
President Donald Trump issued an executive order Wednesday that interprets members of the Jewish religion as part of a distinct nationality. The measure is aimed at helping combat growing anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses, is how the White House describes it.
With one voice, we vow to crush the monstrous evil of anti-Semitism whenever and wherever it appears. And we're working very hard on that. And I can tell you that we have a lot of people in government working very, very hard on that.
Well, while some Jewish organizations are praising the action, it is an issue that's causing divisions within the Jewish community, with some uncomfortable with what they see as creating an ethnic categorization. Joining us to talk more about this is Libby Lenkinsky, Vice President of Public Engagement with the New Israel Fund. Thank you for being with us. How do you see this government action?
The executive order declares that criticism of the Israeli government is equivalent to anti-Semitism and makes it possible to pull federal funding from universities that don't agree to police students' freedom of speech when it comes to Israel. It's an attempt to silence the fundamental freedom to dissent on college campuses, and we know that it's going to be used to silence dissent and smear those who speak up for the rights of Palestinian people and a peaceful future for all. And this is going to contribute to a dangerous chilling effect on college campuses. What I'm worried about, and honestly what I'm experiencing, is a really scary and confusing time for Jewish Americans. We're seeing a rise in people saying and doing anti-Semitic things, including violence and murder. And we're seeing it coming from the highest levels of office, including the White House. The executive order happened a day after President Trump repeated a really ugly and blatant anti-Semitic stereotype to a room full of Jewish people and Israelis at a conference in Florida. And people were outraged and hurt by that and scared, because it's the kind of anti-Semitic rhetoric that fuels violence against us. And then just a day after, he issues this executive order, which he claims is to benefit Jewish people, when in fact it makes us less safe and puts us in an impossible position.
What were the statements that he made?
He talked about that Jews are going to vote to protect their wealth. And that was at a conference in Florida of the Israel America Council, which is an organization that was founded to create bridges between Israeli Americans and Jewish Americans living here in the United States. But since its founding, it's received a lot of financial support from major right-wing Jewish philanthropists. So it's changed the character of that organization.
But what do you interpret that statement to mean?
I think that categorizing Jews as a monolith and monolithic in any way is offensive. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the characteristics of anti-Semitism. And understanding that the Jewish community is diverse in every possible way, including racially, including in terms of class, including geographically, is really important in terms of protecting the safety of Jews in the United States. So when President Trump sort of blankets Jews in mm-hmm. a particular way, mm-hmm. that's the first part of it being offensive. But the second is that it plays on tropes about Jews and money. And those tropes are really dangerous in the current political environment.
Some major Jewish organizations have hailed the action of the executive order by the president.
From my perspective, what this executive order does is gag free speech and silences political dissent, which can only harm all of us, no matter what our religion or beliefs are. So protecting our fundamental freedom of speech is essential in any democracy, especially in the United States, where it's a First Amendment right. And that includes our right to speak out against unjust actions of other governments. And the truth is that there are real problems in Israel, just like there are in America. And when we see those problems, it's our responsibility to speak up against them. So when the Israeli government takes unjust actions that harm Palestinian people's rights and their ability to live their lives and raise their family in peace, it's our moral imperative to speak out about this. And that's our moral imperative also as Jews. So for me, the thing that is so scary is that this order actually fits into a pattern that's shared between the Israeli extreme right-wing government and the American extreme right-wing government, which attempts to silence dissent. And that's dangerous, especially for minorities in a democracy. And here in the United States, Jews are part of that. We are a minority here. The other thing is that it's not going to work, because we will continue to speak the truth about government actions, and we're really concerned about this. So we'll demand that this president stop putting us in danger by repeating ugly rhetoric that's empowering anti-Semitism or anti-immigrant racism or anti-Muslim bigotry or any other means of saying this country is only for people who look like Trump.
People that feel the way you do, how concerned are they?
I believe, and I think most Jews in my community believe, that like all minority groups in our democracy here, Jewish Americans deserve to have our full civil rights protected. protected under the law. But the current law already protects those rights. So limiting the speech of college students to shut down criticism of Trump and his allies abroad is very dangerous for us and for all Americans. And that is what's at the utmost concern to me and to many, many people in my community. In fact, it's anti-Semitic for President Trump to twist the definition of anti-Semitism to further his own narrow political interests. While the executive order is about Jews, mm-hmm. it is also about Palestinians. And Palestinians are living in the region facing grave injustices. And when we silence dissent here in the United States, we are both weaponizing anti-Semitism in the way that the executive order does. But first and foremost, the people that will pay the price for this act are Palestinians who continue to face injustices day after day in their lives as they attempt to raise their families. And we are going to continue to speak up about that in every possible way that we can, as Jews, as Americans, as Israelis, and as Palestinians.
All right. That is Libby Lenkinski. She's the vice president for public engagement with the New Israel Fund. We thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. reaches a tentative trade deal in principle with China. The U.S. hopes a prisoner exchange will lead to broader discussion with Iran. The International Criminal Court president is rejecting criticism that the court targets Africans. And President Trump lambasts Greta Thunberg, Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. North Korea berated the U.S. Thursday for denouncing its ballistic missile test at a United Nations Security Council meeting Wednesday. U.S. Ambassador Kelly Craft said at the meeting that Pyongyang's missile tests were deeply counterproductive and threatened talks to get North Korea to abandon its missile and nuclear programs.
Missile and nuclear testing will not bring the DPRK greater security. It will not bring the DPRK or the region greater stability. It will not help the DPRK achieve the economic opportunities it seeks. In fact, it will do the opposite.
A North Korean foreign ministry spokesman said the ambassador's comments were reckless and, without offering specifics, said the U.S. comments helped Pyongyang make a definite decision about how it will approach North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's year-end deadline for the U.S. to offer mutually acceptable terms to revive the talks. North Korea has conducted multiple missile and rocket tests since May and has suggested it would lift a moratorium on nuclear and long-range missile tests if the U.S. fails to make significant concessions before the new year. Joining us to discuss is Leonid Petrov, Korean studies lecturer and visiting fellow at the Australian National University College of Asia and the Pacific. Well, negotiations stalled last February despite several in-person meetings between President Trump and North Korea's leader. How do you see things now?
There were two major summits between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. One in Singapore in July 2018, when both leaders generally declared that they want to enter the new era of relationship, where denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is going to be part of it and lifting of sanctions was promised. It was a quite declarative but symbolic step forward. The second summit in Hanoi in Vietnam, February 2019, was less than successful, where both sides decided to walk away from a potential deal. Donald Trump was not prepared to take what Kim Jong-un was offered, and Kim Jong-un was expecting America to start incrementally lifting sanctions, which U.S. was not prepared. And ultimately, there was no deal and no statements. And since then, we live in the painful expectation of a new development on this front, which didn't happen. And the third summit, which took place just for a few hours in the demilitarized zone in Panmunjom, and both sides simply exchanged their opinions, but negotiations of the working level of negotiations between North Koreans and Americans collapsed in October. Obviously, North Koreans are not prepared to denuclearize unilaterally, and Americans are not prepared to offer peace to North Korea, which would be lifting of sanctions, diplomatic recognition, and, of course, security assurance.
Do you think that by meeting with Kim Jong-un without any preconditions, did that basically give the U.S. no more leverage to really have a hand to play here?
Well, the U.S. system of international relations is in deep crisis based on a total unreliability of U.S. administration making some arrangements or entering some deals and agreements which can be undone instantly by the following president. Donald Trump is being impeached right now, and so nobody knows what will happen to this agreement between what our promises which Donald Trump had given. It's not the first time we saw that President Obama had a major denuclearization agreement with Iran, which was scrapped by Donald Trump instantly. So North Koreans are not inclined to trust what Donald Trump is saying. So I believe that North Korea has no illusions about the promises which Donald Trump was dangling in front of North Korea as a carrot stimulating the denuclearization, which North Korea understood very differently. For North Koreans, denuclearization must happen on the entire Korean Peninsula, not just in northern side of it. And for the Americans, it's important to see North Korea weak, non-nuclear, and collapsing, preferably. Regime change was expected a long time ago, and it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen because North Korea is consolidating the domestic support every time Americans do something unpalatable for the regime. And so I think nuclear program and ballistic missile program are the tokens of North Korean regime survival. So they're not going to give it up and exchange it for something less useful than security assurance, diplomatic recognition, and lifting of sanctions, which is not happening.
Japan, South Korea, how concerned should they be right now about what is happening?
Very much concerned. They're the first targets, immediate targets, they are neighbors of North Korea. They are in the range of North Korean, both conventional and ballistic style weapons. And South Koreans and Japanese are the allies of the United States, so they are at immediate risk of any potential strike, either deliberate or inadvertent. Someone pushes the wrong button or miscalculates the intentions of U.S. military stationed in South Korea, and Japan, North Koreans wouldn't think twice and push a button.
All right, that's Leonid Petrov, Korean studies lecturer and visiting fellow at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. As Myanmar State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi addressed the International Court of Justice in The Hague this week, many former supporters looked on with dismay as the Nobel Peace Laureate denied accusations that Myanmar's military conducted atrocities against the Rohingya Muslim population. Prosecution lawyers say their actions amount to genocide, and many of her critics say she bears some responsibility for the continued persecution of the Muslim minority, 750,000 of whom have fled the country. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Earlier this month, in Myanmar's western town of Pathein, dozens of Rohingya Muslims were crammed into overcrowded cells. They were jailed on charges of traveling illegally in the country. Human rights groups say it's evidence the Rohingya are still suffering gross abuses.
Rohingya are not granted freedom of movement. We've documented recently forced labor of Rohingya and restrictions on the right to nationality. And we believe that the International Court of Justice should urgently put in place provisional measures in order to end the persecution and ongoing violence against the Rohingya in Rakhine State.
Myanmar's state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi this week defended the country's military against accusations that it waged genocide against the Rohingya. She says their actions were a legitimate response to terrorism.
Myanmar requests the court to remove the case from its list. Steps that generate suspicion, sow doubts, or create resentment between communities who have just begun to build a fragile foundation of trust could undermine reconciliation.
Her appearance and words at The Hague have dismayed many in the West.
The fact that she whitewashed and her team whitewashed the genocide that took place, or did not mention the fact that there was any mass rape, any sexual and gender-based violence that took place, it was quite disturbing.
Aung San Suu Kyi was once seen as a global beacon for human rights, standing up against a military regime that kept her prisoner for most of two decades until 2010. A Nobel Peace Prize winner in 1990 of Myanmar's civilian government in 2016. Former supporters have become vocal critics, accusing her of failing to stop the atrocities against the Rohingya.
She was one person who could have brought people together. She had admiration across religions, across ethnic groups in the country. And she's chosen, instead of doing that, to do the opposite. It turns out that she also has these Buddhist nationalist feelings, that she shares the prejudice against the Rohingya, and she is pursuing policies discriminating against them.
Aung San Suu Kyi retains millions of mainly Buddhist supporters in Myanmar. They insist she is doing her best to govern a multi-ethnic country where the military still holds the reins of power. But Myanmar's minorities feel betrayed.
Other ethnic people are looking at her at this court, defending the military, a military that's committed the same sort of crimes against them for years, and thinking, how can we ever trust this person? How can we trust this woman now?
Will you ever say sorry, Minister?
That's a sentiment shared by many across the globe, who say Aung San Suu Kyi's fall from grace could hardly be more disheartening. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Time magazine selection of Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg as its Person of the Year underscores the growing clout of youth power, pushing governments to escalate the fight against what many consider a crisis. This is also happening in Africa, which is especially vulnerable to climate change. At the Madrid Climate Conference, Lisa Bryant reports on three young Africans who are making a difference.
Lara Muaves works with local communities in Mozambique to ensure sustainable fishing practices, helping them to adapt to a changing climate.
I have a great passion for environment issue, mainly marine.
Mozambique is on the front lines of climate change, which is intensifying weather events. Cyclones in March and April left a trail of destruction. Hundreds of people died, many from disease after the cyclones. Among them, Lara's best friend and collaborator in the fisheries project.
Chris died from malaria. He was there in Ibu. That time he died, 4 people per week, 4 to 8 people were dying, you know, like animals and people. Chris could not escape from the situation.
Several thousand kilometers north in Nigeria, Mahmoud Maishanu is looking for what he calls climate smart solutions for sectors like agriculture, the backbone of Africa's economy.
In my own hometown, not far from where my grandparents are, there's a whole lot of drought and desertification.
He says many Nigerians aren't fully aware of the impact of climate change. Young people are changing that.
I'm seeing a more determining generation. I'm seeing a more determining youth taking action, doing what the previous generation hasn't done for its future generation.
One of those youths is French-Moroccan climate activist Ayoub Makhloufi. He's created a green-friendly torch, sort of like the Olympic one. Today, it travels to each yearly climate meeting.
This year, we traveled from Katowice in Poland to Belém in Brazil by electric car, train, and sailboat.
Makhloufi wants to help find financing for African environmental projects and build climate awareness in schools. He sees the challenges in his parents' native Morocco.
Lack of water, lack of education, especially in terms of sustainable development.
But he remains optimistic the world will find solutions to climate change. The challenge is finding the right ones so everyone can benefit. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Madrid.
And you're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On our
voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi-Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. So Rwanda this week hosted the annual Anti-Corruption Excellence Award ceremony to highlight and encourage successes against graft, including it at home. Transparency International ranks Rwanda as the fourth least corrupt country in Africa behind the Seychelles, Botswana, and Cape Verde. Eugene Uwumana reports from Kigali.
Rwanda and Qatar co-hosted this year's Anti-Corruption Excellence Award Summit in Kigali, known as the AC Award, to recognize and support efforts to reject graft. The Economic Commission for Africa, ECA, and the African Union Commission, AUC, estimate illicit financial flows in Africa average an annual $50 billion to $148 billion. Transparency International ranks Rwanda the fourth least corrupt country in Africa, however, and the second least corrupt on the mainland after Botswana.
Compared to maybe other countries, African countries, I can say that Rwanda at least tried to do its best, even if we have still a long way before us.
Putting government services online is one measure Rwanda has taken to prevent corruption. While higher-level corruption is no longer rampant, Rwandans say you can still run into local corruption.
In many cases, you find that for a local leader to help you at a local sector level, he sometimes tells you, buy me a beer. It is not done like this, without respecting the law.
Nigeria is routinely ranked one of the more corrupt nations in Africa. At Nigeria hosted the African Union Summit on Corruption in June, Rwanda's President Paul Kagame said facing down graft was a choice.
This is a campaign that can be won. Tolerating corruption is a choice, not an inevitability.
Aside from the Anti-Corruption Summit, Qatar also sponsored a monument in Rwanda that represents public solidarity in the ongoing fight against graft. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Beyoncé's Lemonade is named the Associated Press Album of the Decade. The news organization says they felt even at the beginning of this decade, Beyoncé was the greatest singer of her generation. She has won a record 6 Grammys in a single night, had women and men owing to the fun sound of Single Ladies, and continued to be one heck of a performer, they said. If that weren't enough, like a boss, she launched her own entertainment company and recorded a series of hits and classics. But the Associated Press says Beyoncé topped herself again with Lemonade, which still tastes as good as it did when it was released in 2016. Usually private, Beyoncé bares her soul on the album, singing about a troubled relationship, black pride, and motherhood in a very brave way. And you have been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Tony Pollock. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
home.